Crib Notes, what parents Google at 3am.
Powered by the Breastfeeding Friend.
For breastfeeding advice, available 24/7 on Amazon Alexa and Google Assistant.
This is Crib Notes, things parents Google at 3am. So every episode, we look at things that crop up with your baby's health with paediatrician, new mum, Dr. Sarah Blackstock, and dad-to-be, me, Rick Kelsey, talking about the most common questions that you want to know and get answered about your baby.
Don't forget, what's discussed today is the opinions of the individuals and not the organisations they work for.
And while we hope you find this podcast helpful, remember, this is not personal medical advice. If you are concerned, do speak to a professional.
So today we are going to talk vaccinations with Professor Helen Bedford from the University College London, who's basically the person whose name comes up after you've Googled vaccines. Isn't that right, Helen?
I couldn't possibly say.
Sarah, this is something that you get so many questions on.
It is. So thank you, Helen. I've got lots and lots of questions for you lots of mums. Can we start by just, if you could just tell us a bit about what the current vaccination programme is?
Yep, sure. So children under five are offered vaccines against 14 diseases. That includes flu, 4 vaccines to prevent against different types of meningitis, so-called old-fashioned diseases like diphtheria and polio, tetanus, measles, mumps, rubella. So these are diseases that are considered to be extremely serious. Children can be very ill with them, but more importantly, they can develop complications that can last for life or even die, and that's why these diseases are important to prevent.
One thing that a lot of parents want to know is they have exact timeframes when they are in the red book, when we're told to go to the GP. But actually, mums are telling me they can't get to the GP on that day, or, for example, they're going away.
It doesn't have to be exactly on the day. So the way the schedule is worked out, the timings of the vaccines, is that they start at 8 weeks, the routine vaccines. And what we're trying to do is give them early so that you protect children before they get to the age where they're at risk of disease. But if you started too early, the baby's immune system isn't ready and can't sort of respond properly to them and develop protection. So a day or two here or there doesn't matter at all. But it is important to get all the vaccines in the schedule, so to have all the doses recommended, because that's how you get best protection, and that includes the booster doses that are given just before children go to school.
So a day or two here there is all right.
Or even a week?
Even a week's fine. I mean, yeah. Clearly, you know, you don't want to be months over, but a day or two or a week's okay.
I think a lot of people kind of worry, don't they, about giving the kid all these vaccinations together, and you'll kind of think that it's going to overload your immune system. Is that just a natural worry?
This is something that people worry about. We do give a lot of vaccines. The reason we give them in combination or all at the same time is because it's much nicer for babies to have one jab rather than six. So if you think about it, if you took the 6 in one jab, that's the diphtheria, tetanus, whooping cough, etc., and you gave it separately, that would be 6 different injections. So your baby would have 6 sore bits instead of one. They might have 6 reactions where they're unhappy and distressed, maybe get a fever instead of one. So it makes sense to combine them. And by combining them, it means also that you get the protection earlier, because if you space them all out, obviously children are going to be older. And there's no evidence to show that it's a problem. So if you think about a baby born in hospital, you take them out into whatever street you're going to be in, immediately they're bombarded with all that stuff, viruses, bacteria. Every time they eat, they breathe, they're dealing with these things, you know. And then when they get a bit older and they start ramming things in their mouth, they're dealing with all this stuff all the time. Mm. What's contained in vaccines is absolutely minuscule compared to all that. And what all that exposure to these so-called antigens does is gives you a robust immune system, which is what vaccines also do.
The Crib Notes podcast is a co-production with The Breastfeeding Friend. It's available on Amazon Alexa and Google Assistant.
This skill has been loaded with loads of new amazing features and information, such as soothing sounds and relaxing music and lullabies for you and your baby during those exhausting night feeds. Plus, Crib Notes is on there too.
How was Daisy Sarah when you got her vaccinated?
Daisy was fine, but it was actually really interesting being on the other side. As a fluffy paediatrician, we're always really understanding to parents, but actually, I never really understood why parents were worried that their child would be in pain. I thought, well, they should know that they're doing the right thing. But for the record, so that you know, your child will not remember and you have done the right thing. So just remember that.
We talk about it all the time. We hear it all the time. But what exactly is the MMR and should people be getting it privately, separately?
Okay, so MMR stands for measles, mumps, rubella. So it's a combination vaccine. The vaccine contains weakened live viruses to give babies protection against the three diseases. Should they get it privately, singly? I would say absolutely no. There's no need to do that. You know, again, it's about getting the protection all in one go. There's a load of evidence about MMR's vaccine safety and effectiveness, and it's a very safe vaccine, which works really well. Now, on the other hand, we have never given separate measles, mumps, rubella vaccine to young children. So you can't say, OK, this is a good idea, because we simply don't know if it's a good idea. We don't know if it's safe. We don't know if it's effective. We don't know what interval there should be. We do know all that for MMR. And I would say go with what the evidence shows works best. And another issue is you might not be able to get all these separate vaccines. You might not be able to get the mumps vaccine. So you set out getting them privately at great expense. You don't need to do that. And then you might not be able to complete the course.
I've just realised that my mug says keep calm and carry on vaccinating.
Absolutely.
How much is it if you wanted to get it privately?
I don't even know, but you know,
it's a couple of hundred pounds.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you don't know what the vaccines you're getting, where
the
they're coming from,
or anything. Yeah.
You know, and there have been stories in the past of people using vaccines that are unregulated, don't work so well. So, I wouldn't go there. You want to get something that the NHS says is okay.
I suppose that kind of leads me on to the kind of the next question, really. So that is the MMR, but why then are people still getting measles?
Okay, this is really complicated. In this country, in the UK, as people probably remember, there was a bit of a hoo-ha about 20 years ago when parents became scared that MMR might cause autism as a result of a publication which is totally discredited and has been removed from the record now. So lots of children didn't get immunised then. Mm. This means that a lot of the measles we're seeing now is in that age group, these older teenagers, young adults who weren't immunised when they're babies. Now, people may have also heard about loads of measles in other countries, and this is all for different reasons. So some of that is because of toddlers who, you know, young adults who weren't immunised when they were toddlers. Some of it is due to economic, political crisis, which means that people aren't, you know, health services have broken down. So if you think about Syria, you know, it's in a real state there, and there's lots of people not getting immunised and people getting measles. So different things going on. But the reason why we're seeing them is measles is the most infectious disease there is. So as soon as you get any decline at all in vaccine uptake, you start seeing outbreaks because it spreads like wildfire.
So that's why more people are getting it. But how dangerous can it be?
It can be really nasty. So measles disease, uncomplicated measles, is nasty. It makes children feel ill. It keeps the young children in bed, which is quite unusual. It takes a lot to keep a young kid in bed. So that's the kind of, you know, mild picture, if you like, but it has lots of complications too. So you can have fits, you can get pneumonia, inflammation of the brain occurs in about 1 in 1,000 children, and about 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 3,000 die from measles. So last year in Europe, which is a rich place, 80 people died from measles. These are really shocking statistics. So it's not a benign disease at all. It can be extremely nasty and leave people with lifelong complications.
A couple of the parents I've been talking to have been saying, well, you know, can you not just wait for, you know, the children to catch this naturally? Or, you know, do we have to have the immunisations? Is there any other way around?
Well, we give these immunisations because these diseases can be very serious. So if you catch the disease, you run the risk of having a really serious illness, having a complication. You know, meningitis, septicemia, children end up with their limbs amputated. They end up brain damaged. Do you really want to run that risk?
I mean, we see children in intensive care with these conditions. They're just so serious. It's just not worth the risk.
I think the trouble is in this country a little bit is that because children get so few illnesses now because of vaccination, we forget how ill children can be.
Yeah.
And we don't see seriously ill children. I mean, my children are young adults. The worst they ever had was chickenpox.
Yeah.
They never got anything. So we're just not used to seeing how awful these diseases are. They're truly devastating.
I think that in some ways vaccines have been a victim of their own success because people don't see these conditions. So they think, oh, why would I need that vaccine? There's potentially risks. Everyone else is having them. But you forget, actually, the only reason you're not is because everyone around you is immunising. You know, if you go to Africa, you know, we see it all the time. And actually, we still do in the UK see these tragic things. But because you don't necessarily know the person who was unfortunate to have that, you don't realise.
Absolutely, that's a really important point. And on the other side, you do see children with autism, and people talk about children with autism, but you don't see the other side of the story at all. Children with these devastating diseases that have killed millions of children over the years.
There is a really noisy, and I'm going to use the word noisy on purpose, anti-vaccine movement around though, Helen, isn't there?
Yeah, I think noisy is the right word, because sometimes people say the rise of the anti-vaccine movement. Well, actually, it's always been there. So the first vaccine was developed at the end of the 1700s, smallpox vaccine. Mm. There was an anti-vaccine movement. So it's always been there. But now it's noisy because we see it on social media, on Twitter, all over the place. So actually, in terms of size, it's quite small. It's a small number of people that shout a lot. In this country, the overwhelming majority of children are immunised. It's over 90% of children go along, get their vaccinations, and most parents are confident in vaccines. Mm. So, but it's just it's the sort of silent majority that you don't hear from.
I'm just thinking about, you know, if you've got so much going on when you're a new mum or a new dad, is it possible that you can kind of forget that your kid is not being vaccinated, even though you want them to be vaccinated?
I think it's
fair.
Your
red book. Yeah.
You have your red book.
I've got this in my bag now. I mean, you do have, you know, so many prompts from your health visitor, the midwife, you have a GP. But having said that, you know, there are people who can't get into their GP practice.
It's true. And the thing is that, you know, if you're, say, a mum and you've got three children, all different ages, one at primary school, one at nursery, one somewhere else, and you've got an appointment for a vaccination and you just can't get to it. I mean, it's, you know, of course it's easy to forget these things. You know, even though it's a high priority, you think, oh, I'll do it next week or whatever. So I can completely understand that because people are busy and there's a lot going on.
And I think people are understandably scared because people are accessing information in different ways now. And, you know, on social media, it is almost an echo chamber. And actually, you only ever hear the bad side, don't you, the anti-vaccine narrative. And, you know, people believe what they want to believe, and it's sometimes they can scare people who just don't know, and parents all want to do the right thing, but when that's what you're hearing, you know, it's understandable why people believe that.
Of course, it's I mean, we all read the newspapers that, you know, we believe in politically, don't we? So if you have already got doubts in your mind about immunisation and then you find information that confirms that, it is an echo chamber. So what I would say is don't go to social media or the internet for information about immunisation. Speak to your health professional. And there are other good, reliable sources, but it's not always easy to work out which sources are reliable.
So I understand that, you know, some mums and dads choose not to vaccinate their children. But actually, is it compulsory, Helen? Should it be compulsory?
Well, this is an interesting debate, and there's a lot going on about this at the moment. So in this country, it isn't compulsory at all. The sort of classic example of where it is the United States, where it's been compulsory for several decades. But other countries are recently bringing in some sort of compulsion, either a fine or you can't go to school unless your child's had this vaccination. Personally, I don't think there's any good evidence to support making vaccination mandatory. There's no evidence that it actually increases uptake rates. And what it might do is it's not going to have any effect on somebody who's determinedly, I'm not going to get my child vaccinated. It's going to have no impact on them at all. But people that, you know, have maybe have doubts, don't know what to do, it might make them think, oh, well, if they're telling me this is what I've got to do, I'm not going to do it. And the big problem, I think, is it's always the already disadvantaged who become more disadvantaged. So if you impose a fine, if you're rich, you can just pay it. But if you're poor, what do you do? If you stop children going to school, and, you know, what happens to the disadvantaged? You know, rich people can just have homeschooling or whatever, get in private tutors, but poor people can't afford that. So it's always the poor that are disadvantaged. And there is evidence coming out from Australia where they've introduced some kind of mandation that it is actually benefit or of least benefit.
And I guess they're probably to the highest risk population as well.
Exactly. It's a double whammy. So it's I don't think there's a place for it in this country, but it's very context specific. It depends on your country and their values and all sorts of things. So you can't, you know, say across the board.
One of the things that you kind of hear about the MMR vaccine in the past has been the word autism has surrounded it. I mean, to kind of set the record straight, does MMR possibly give people autism?
No, absolutely not. So how this came about was over 20 years ago, a paper was published in The Lancet, which is a very prestigious medical journal. And it was it described a case series of 12 children that had been seen in a clinic. Some of them had autism or were thought to be autistic. And eight of the children, when they asked the history, they said, oh, we think it came on soon after MMR. And the authors, interestingly and importantly, the authors of the paper said we did not prove an association between autism and MMR vaccine. But it was the lead author, whose name I will not mention, who felt that there was a real issue and has subsequently taken this, you know, to the nth degree. And broadcast it, and he's now not just anti-MMR, he's anti all vaccines. What's happened in the 21-year period since then is a load of research has been conducted. In fact, there's more research being conducted on MMR than virtually any other medical intervention. So we've got a lot of really robust evidence from all around the world showing no link with MMR and autism at all, and they've, you know, different studies have been done looking to see whether children whose siblings have got autism are at great, you know, at risk of autism with MMR. No connection at all. So it's bottom line. There is a lot of evidence showing absolutely no link.
And this evidence is from thousands and thousands of people, isn't it?
Millions,
and it's really, really detailed compared to the case series that he did.
So if that's you and kind of, you know, your kids, so you're happy, right, I'm going to immunise my kids, great, they're safe. But then you rock up into kind of class on the first day you send them to a nursery or the first day they go into school. Do you know if the other kids who are playing with your kids have also been vaccinated?
No, not necessarily. No, not at all. So I suppose it depends on the policy of the nursery or the school. You know, some nurseries are saying we're not going to let children enter unless they're vaccinated. But otherwise, no, you're not going to know. And the problem with a lot of these infectious diseases is that you are most infectious before you develop symptoms. That's how the diseases spread. They're quite clever.
That's like the flu, isn't it?
Well, all of them, you know, chickenpox, measles, they're all infectious before you actually get symptoms. So you can't always say, oh, that person's got a disease. So this is why when people say, I'm going to, you know, not take my children anywhere and not let them be with people who've got the infections, are misguided, because you don't know who's got the infections.
And things like the MMR, you can't even have it till 12 months. So those children are exposed anyway when they haven't been vaccinated. Yes. Yeah. So that's also a problem.
And I know, Sarah, you're really keen on making sure that the kids pick stuff up off the dog floor.
Well, I don't want them to be too clean, no. Yeah. That's the excuse for my house, probably.
No, well, there's good evidence to show that children who are brought up on farms are much less likely to have allergies than, you know, uber-clean children.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think all these, you know, sprays are just... Absolutely.
It's killing your first line of immune response.
If you're brought up in an urban jungle... Maybe that's all right as well.
Well, the bit of pollution isn't too good for you. But, you know, a bit of dirt. What do they say? A peck of dirt before you die? I don't know how much a peck is, but that's what they used to say.
One of the questions, actually, just from what you've said just then, which I've been asked, I think I got three messages on the same day before Baby Sensory, was there's a big outbreak recently in Fulham of measles, and people were saying, you know, I can't take my baby to sensory. What do you say to mums who are really anxious about that? Because I think it's tricky to keep them cooped up at home when, you know, they can't have a vaccine until they're 12 months anyway, and you don't know who's actually infectious.
I think it's a really difficult question, actually, because you don't want to, you know, you want your children to mix and be learning all those things about mixing with other children, and to keep them cooped up until they're vaccinated is not the way to go. But on the other hand, it's difficult. You don't want to expose your child to a disease. So you just hope that, you know, other parents are sensible and responsible.
Can we talk about the HPV vaccine? That's being extended to boys, isn't it?
Yeah, it's coming. So from September, it will be offered to boys. That's boys in year eight, sort of a 12, 13. So it was introduced for girls 10 years ago, 2008. And it was introduced to prevent infection that causes cervical cancer. And a number of countries, notably Australia and United States, have been using it amongst boys and girls for many years, and it's shown to be highly effective, fantastic vaccine. And now they're introducing it for boys. The reason there was a delay is because in this country, any vaccine has to be shown to be cost effective. You know, we've got an NHS, there's a limited pot of money. You can't just be buying everything willy-nilly. So they had to have good evidence to show it was going to be cost effective. And we're now able to offer it to boys, which is really exciting. So boys can also get cancers from HPV, cancers of rude places like their penis and their anus, but also of the mouth and throat, which those sorts of cancers are increasing in the population, and particularly in young men, and really serious. So this is fantastic, you know, that they're all going to have this protection now.
And something that Sarah gets messages about all the time, because one of the reasons that obviously we set up this podcast was because Sarah just gets so many WhatsApps in the middle of the night saying, is this normal? Is that? And with pictures of all sorts of stuff.
She should.
But one question you get all the time, Sarah, is about chickenpox, isn't it?
Chickenpox vaccine. So it's not currently on the programme, but a few people have been asking, should they get it privately? Should they wait and just get natural exposure?
Okay, another tricky question. So the reason we don't have it on the routine schedule is, again, cost effectiveness, but it is offered to high-risk groups. So if you, say, had a child who had a sibling who had something like leukemia, then you could get it, and also healthcare professionals should have it. But it isn't on the schedule at the moment. So the question, should you pay for it? Well, it's difficult. It's another one of these things that chickenpox, when you're a child, is usually mild. There can be nasty complications, but they're uncommon.
You worry about it, I think, if you're a new kind of mum or dad, because you know it's coming, don't you? It's one of those ones that you know is coming, because it's going to happen. And, you know, I can't remember much from when I was below five, but I can remember, I say this in my 30s, I can remember having chickenpox, and I've still, and it does leave its marks. I've still got little holes in my cheek from when I had them. And it you do worry, I think, as a parent, because it's one that you can't avoid.
Well, it's probably because it's the only thing that children get now, because everything else is vaccinated against. The bottom line is, you don't want to have chickenpox as an adult, because it's much more serious as an adult, much more complicated. You want children to have it as children. So whether you should pay for the vaccine privately is an issue. You know, it's something you need to decide if you want to do. The other thing people often talk about is chickenpox parties, and I would definitely not suggest chickenpox parties.
Really? I've heard about loads of those.
Simply because you don't know who else is there. I mean, it could be a kid who's got some immune problem, and getting chickenpox is going to be a major big deal for them. So I don't think any healthcare professional would say knowingly expose your child to an infection. You know, it's just not what you would recommend.
Yeah. But you don't know it's definitely chickenpox.
No. But on the other hand, you want children to get it rather than adults. So it's a bit of a, you know, it's a bit of a
and
tricky one.
With the chickenpox vaccine, there's still a chance of getting chickenpox, isn't there? And you have to have a second dose because, well, for example, in America, where everyone has the chickenpox vaccine, they have to redose it because there's no underlying chickenpox in the actual community.
Yeah. What you want is, with any vaccine, you want to get high vaccine uptake, because if you have you know, say 50% are immunised, you'll still get chickenpox circulating, but it just means that when you catch it, you're older because there's less of it around. Mm. The other thing with chickenpox, the reason we haven't introduced it here so quickly is because one of the things that chickenpox does is sort of tops up people's immunity so you don't get shingles as an older person, which is really nasty. Now, they've introduced a shingles vaccine recently for over 70s, and I'm pretty sure that we will introduce chickenpox vaccine sooner or later. It's probably, you know, next on the list of things that will be introduced. But again, it's about cost effectiveness.
And I think some people say, well, their child often gets chickenpox around the time that they're having their second child, and actually they have to take so much time off work, and that's one of the reasons why they do the vaccine. Is that a good enough reason?
Well, one of the big reasons is the savings economically of parents having to take. That's one of the things in America they introduced it for, because people had to take time off because their children were ill. It was a big consideration. This thing called herd immunity, which I don't like the term because it's, you know, we're not baby cows. Community immunity, that you're not, when you're immunising your child, you're not just doing it for their own protection, but it's for those around you that can't be immunised. So young babies, like we were talking about, can't have MMR, pregnant women, older people, people with chronic health conditions who might be really ill if they can't be immunised. So there is this kind of public responsibility as well as doing it for to protect your own child. If enough people are immunised, the diseases go because of the level of immunity. So it's really important.
Helen, thank you so much for coming on Crib Notes.
It's a pleasure. It's nice to meet you.
I just think, because it's a bit of a minefield, isn't it, I think?
I think it's very difficult for parents because everybody wants to do their best for their children. That's all we want to do. But some of these decisions sometimes can be quite, you know, upsetting, especially when you're a new parent, you know, you're knackered, getting used to this new baby and you have to make this big decision. I think it can be difficult, but, you know, I think it's important to talk to healthcare professionals and ask questions. That's the important thing. Ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask questions.
Crib Notes, what parents Google at 3 a.m.
Powered by the Breastfeeding Friend.
For breastfeeding advice, available 24/7 on Amazon Alexa and Google Assistant.
Thanks for listening to Crib Notes on Vaccinations with Dr. Sarah and Professor Helen Bedford and me. Don't forget to listen to our episodes coming up on reflux, baby jaundice, and how to spot if your child is unwell. If you are unsure, seek personal professional advice. From all the Crib Notes team, we'll see you next time.